You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Nikolai Razanov, a diplomat, adventurer, courtier, and gambler, dreamed of establishing Russian colonies from Siberia to California. And the Russian Empire had outposts in California and Hawaii in 1818. From 1812 to 1842, Spain, Russia, and the United States converged on Fort Ross, north of San Francisco, to compete for territory. It was there that Razanov asked Conchita Arguello, the daughter of a Spanish governor, to marry him. That love story was the basis of a wildly popular Russian rock opera, and that inspired Owen Matthews to write about Nikolai Razanov's life and legacy. His book, Glorious Misadventures, is published by Bloomsbury, and it brings Owen Matthews to our show today. Hello.
Hello, Mr. Lopate. What an honor.
What's the name of the rock opera that's based on Nikolai Razanov's engagement to Conchita Arguello?
It's called Yunona y Avois, which means nothing. It's the names of two ships, the Juno and the Avois. But it came out in 1983, and it was
this. Well, that's before the fall of communism.
Right. That was what made it so surprising and amazing and avant-garde. It's like the Savior Jesus Christ Superstar, except that it's about this Russian adventurer. He's a kind of romantic hero in the opera. I don't think he really was a romantic hero in real life, but I guess we'll get to that. And it's about this sort of great sort of meeting of continents. It's about, you know, a Russian conqueror, a Russian 19th century conquistador showing up in Spanish California and conquering its fairest daughter.
Now, rock music aside, do you think that Stalin or Khrushchev or Brezhnev would have approved?
Well, it's funny. For a long time, the Soviets didn't like Razanov at all because they found him because he's an imperialist. He's a Russian imperialist.
And he's, you mean there was no Russian expansionism?
Well, they thought, you know, the sort of Tsarist era expansionism was sort of politically incorrect, of course. But ultimately, he's now become very fashionable because now, you know, Russia, for various unpleasant reasons, is starting to rediscover its sort of expansionism and its imperial past. So actually, the whole story of Russia's conquest of or colonization of chunks of America has actually become very fashionable.
Now, when did you first see this rock opera?
I first saw it as a kid in Moscow in 1986 or thereabouts. I was 15 years old. My mother was Russian, and but she emigrated in 1969. I was born in London. But as a child, I would go fairly regularly to visit my Soviet relatives. And I was taken as a special treat to this extravaganza. And I heard for the first time this true story, amazing true story, of Imperial Russia's attempt to colonize America.
Well, that was a long time ago, but you finally have written the book?
Well, it appeals to me because it's such a mad, unlikely story. And Razanov is in many ways an unsympathetic hero because his shipmates hated him. They thought he was sort of pompous and obnoxious, and he probably was. And by the end, he actually declares a sort of private war on Japan. So I think he actually also goes a little bit insane. So it's a sort of strange mixture. One reviewer, I think, from the Financial Times very kindly said that it's a mixture of Gogol's The Government Inspector and Heart of Darkness. And it's true because it's about this man. He's a courtier. He's an aristocrat. He's an adventurer. He's a man of the sort of glittering world of the court of St. Petersburg, who suddenly finds himself like at the far end of the world, you know, the Northern Pacific in Alaska, starving, you know, completely, you know, far from authority, and he finds himself the czar and the god, as the Russians say, and out there in the wilderness, he discovers a sort of world historical démarche. He discovers that he, as the Russian Empire, can suddenly conquer this vast swathe of territory, California, which is unclaimed.
What, did Russia already kind of own Alaska at that point?
Yeah, there was they had a series of not very successful colonies in Alaska, and there were constantly problems with supplies. But what Razanov saw, and what makes him a fascinating character, is that he sees the world as it could be, not as it was.
Well, let's back up a bit. Mm-hmm. What was his upbringing like? Wasn't his father missing between when he was 3 to when he was 30?
Right. He grew up as a he had a very typical Russian aristocratic upbringing. He was sent to join the army when he was 14. His father went off to Siberia, where he was a judge. And his father was they were from a poor aristocratic family. And for poor aristocratic families in Europe, it was very common to go out into the colonies, to go to India and the West Indies, etc. But for Russia, the colonies were Siberia. That was the land of opportunity. That was the new world for Russians. So they would go east to seek their fortunes, and that's exactly what Rezanov's father did to this sort of freewheeling, sort of swashbuckling, dangerous world of lawless world of Siberia, which was the wild east.
And he never went to visit his father?
It took 6 months each way.
You say that he'd mastered five languages by the time he was 15. Was this just expected of a bright young kid in St. Petersburg?
I think it was partly expected. I think he was unusually bright and talented. I think he was a brilliant courtier. He was a brilliant wheeler-dealer. He was a politician. He was a guy who was willing to catch the main chance. But yeah, he was a talented linguist and a talented. He was very good at persuading people, telling them what they wanted to hear. He managed to get on the right side of three successive rulers of Russia: Catherine II, her son, the Emperor Paul I, and her grandson, Alexander I, and they all hated each other. Three generations of one family. The mother hated and distrusted her son Paul. The son Paul thought that his mother was trying to poison him. He hated everyone who supported Catherine. The grandson was brought up by Catherine, by his grandmother, and somehow Rezanov manages to charm these three generations of one family and get them on his side. So obviously the guy has highly developed diplomatic skills.
My guess is Owen Matthews, whose latest book is follow-up to Stalin's Children, is Glorious Misadventures, Nikolai Rezanov and the Dream of a Russian America. There's an illustration in the book of Rezanov's three sailing routes to American territories, 1804, 1805, and 1806. The first stopped in Hawaii on the way to the Marquesas Islands. What did he do there?
Well, the story comes into its own. He sets off in 1803 from St. Petersburg on a round-the-world expedition.
And to do what? Just to see the world?
Essentially to resupply, to find if there's a way to resupply Russia's colonies on the American continent, to open trade routes with Japan, because his vision was to make Russia the center of a Pacific Triangle trade.
But leaving St. Petersburg, how does he get to the other side?
Well, with difficulty. He goes via Brazil.
And so Argentina. He went around the bottom of South America.
Around the Cape of Good Hope, yeah. So Cape Horn, I beg your pardon.
Because he could have just gone to Siberia, and it would have been a lot shorter trip to Hawaii.
Yeah, that's true. But you would have to have a ship, and there weren't any at that point on Russia's eastern seaboard. You had to sort of sail one there yourself. So, but one of the interesting things about the story is that for already by this time, Yankee skippers out of Rhode Island and Boston are regularly showing up at these Russian outposts on the American continent in Alaska. They're regularly showing up with supplies, and they're trading furs, which was tremendously valuable. Like, the baseline of this whole imperial story is fur, because they called it soft gold. One pelt of sea otter, it's a beautiful creature, it's 5 foot long, sea mammal. One pelt was worth 1 year's income for an ordinary sailor in the markets of Canton in China. It was an enormously valuable commodity at that time. So Yankees were actually already regularly trading up and down that coast, up to 10 ships a year. So one of the problems that Rezanov faced is that actually the Yankee skippers are doing a much better job of trading and supplying those Russian outposts than the Russians themselves were.
So he wanted to bring the business back home. But meanwhile, he goes to Hawaii, actually establishes Fort Elizabeth on Kauai.
That was actually one of his employees. The Russian colony slightly absurd. Like many stories linked to Russian America, it's a story of sort of catastrophic failure. But indeed, one of Rezanov's subordinates, Georg Schaefer, does indeed found a colony on Hawaii and talks the ruler of Kauai, with one of the islands of the Hawaiian Peninsula, into swearing allegiance to the Tsar. And
he named it after the Tsarina Elizabeth.
Yes. And for a while, the Russian imperial flag flew over Kauai, one of the islands of Hawaii, until the king, Kamehameha, got together a small fleet, actually of Yankee ships, and kicked them out. But Russia briefly had a little colony on Hawaii.
And then when did he go to California?
Rezanov shows up in California in 1806 after a terrible winter, starving among the Russian colonists, because the Russian colonists are completely unable to feed themselves in Alaska. The climate is they find the climate actually quite warm. Only a Russian could write of Alaska. They often do, like, how warm it is here. Like, but they're coming from Siberia, so I guess relative to Siberia, it is warm. But they can't feed themselves. The colony is starving. So what Rezanov does is that he buys a Yankee ship that happens to show up. He writes a check for it, literally, for $68,000. The skipper, being a game fellow, John DeWolf, takes the check, sells him the ship, and Rezanov goes south to California in search of provisions. And also, what he finds is...
The ship was the Juno.
The Juno. And what he finds is Conchita.
In 1805, you say, the Juno was only 5 miles from Lewis and Clark's winter camp,
right.
Fort Clatsop.
Yes.
But
yes.
Their paths never crossed. What do you think would have happened if they had?
It's one of the funniest incidents of that journey, because, of course... in 1803, a couple of years previously, the United States, fledgling United States, buys the Louisiana Territory, which is way bigger, of course, than the state of Louisiana. It's actually part of 13 states and 3 Canadian provinces. It's a vast sort of swathe of the middle.
But it didn't include California.
No. Just right up to the Rockies. And George Washington commissions two young officers, Lewis and Clark, sends them to basically explore.
Was it Washington or Jefferson?
I think you're right. Yeah. I think it was Jefferson. I beg your pardon. And sends them to cross country, and they end up at on the Pacific coast. Exactly at that time, I've never the Juno with the Russians aboard is sailing up and down. They don't see each other. Lewis and Clark send scouts to the coast. They don't see, for about 5 days, they're within a couple of miles of each other. And what would have happened if they'd met? I don't know. I mean, they were both exploring this huge, wealthy no man's land. But neither of them, neither Lewis and Clark nor Rezanov, really had the means to conquer this great land.
So Rezanov meets Conchita. He's 42. She's 15.
Right.
And he comes with a reputation. How long did he know her? How did he come to know her? And how long before he proposed to her?
Well, indeed, the reputation. I mean, let's put it this way: she was not the first teenage heiress in his life. His wife had also been, who he married when she was 14, was tremendously wealthy, daughter of a great Siberian fur merchant.
Was this a bigamous situation?
No. He was a widower by that time. He shows up, and he must have been pretty charming, because within 3 weeks of his appearing in California, he's already engaged to this woman who is described as the beauty of the Californias.
Did her parents support the possible marriage?
Her parents were. I think it's pretty clear that they were dazed and confused by this whole situation, because this man shows up with his breath stinking with scurvy, starving in his finery, in his uniform, and his jeweled whatnots, in his diamond-encrusted Order of St. Anne and everything. And he's certainly the grandest and most impressive man who's ever shown up at this remote colony. San Francisco, at that point, the Spanish population of San Francisco was 32 people. Hmm. It was at the end of the earth. It was at least a 4 week journey to Mexico City, and suddenly this sort of magnificent apparition appears, and he proposes marriage to their teenage daughter, and says that he's going to get a special dispensation from the Pope to marry, so that she doesn't have to convert from Catholicism. And he's going to get a special dispensation from the King of Spain. He has all these sort of great world historical schemes involving their teenage daughter.
And her father, of course, is wealthy. Do you think that Rezanov loved Conchita, or that his proposal was purely political, or a desire to have a rich wife?
Well, he's that's one of the questions that I struggle with in the book, because from every side, the relationship is portrayed as being cynical. Rezanov himself portrays it as being calculated when he writes to the directors of the Russian-American company, which he set up. But the thing is that the Russian-American company, this great trading empire that he himself heads, is run by his former wife's, his late wife's relatives. So it's kind of natural that he would present it as being sort of calculated to them. When he writes to the Russian government, he also presents it as being a sort of calculated political thing, but also I think he's being defensive. The truth, I think that he was an elderly or middle-aged widower, and I think he really did feel something for Conchita.
But they didn't get married.
I won't give away the end of the story, but he doesn't ever get back to California. He's accident befalls him.
And was that the end of Russian dreams of establishing colonies in North America?
Russia, subsequent to poor Rezanov's death in 1807, Russia never loses an opportunity to miss an opportunity in the New World, because in the 1820s, the Empire of Mexico, in other words, the former Spanish colonies of in the New World, offer California to the Tsar in 1821 in exchange for guns and recognition. And Tsar Nicholas I says, like, no thanks, why would we need that? And they sell their only colony in California, the Fort Ross colony on the Russian River,
So that's why it's called the Russian River. I always wondered.
Right, because it was a southern boundary
of
Russia.
They could have had good wine in Russia.
Well, good wine, but 7 years after they sold it, part of that territory contained the Klondike. It was the biggest gold strike in the history of history, and the Russians, lost it. Then they sold Alaska to the United States in 1867. The Klondike, the gold rush is in 1897, but the California gold rush is in 1849. They sell up just a few years before that. So basically, they have like perfectly bad timing. They sell California just before the gold rush. They sell Alaska just before the gold rush. And, sadly, they've just utterly failed, sadly for Russia.
In October 2000, there was a service for the dead and a dedication of a memorial to Rezanov in Krasnoyarsk, Siberia.
Right.
I guess he now is considered a hero, a missed opportunity.
Yeah, I think right now, as I started to say earlier, the Russian Empire has become very fashionable these days. And it's become very fashionable to wax nostalgic about this, the great imperial opportunities that Russia missed.
Owen Matthews was for many years Newsweek's bureau chief in Moscow. He's written for the Moscow Times, the Times of London, The Spectator, and The Independent. And he has written a number of books, one, Stalin's Children, now Glorious Misadventures, Nikolai Rezanov, and The Dream of a Russian America. It's published by Bloomsbury. Thank you so much for being on our show.
It's a great pleasure, Mr. Lippin.
Thank you.